Hi everyone. In today's episode, we speak to investing reporter for Business Insider, Leila Maiden. She tells us how it was her career in foreign policy and international relations, during which time she actually worked with the United Nations, that she became motivated to share global developments with the general public and hence switched to a career in journalism. Leila is now a reporter in Business Insider's markets division, and her coverage predominantly focuses on cryptocurrencies, the stock market, and trading strategies. She's particularly passionate about sharing the stories of people who have overcome struggle and attained financial freedom by growing their personal wealth. And it's actually through one of these stories that we came across Leila. We discuss this and others during the episode, as well as recent trends in the world of blockchain. And you can find links to the articles that we mentioned below, as well as Leila's profile. But please note, this is not financial advice. So for today's episode, we decided to include a slightly longer introductory section because we thought it was really important to clarify the context and the reason behind inviting Leila to join us for this episode. Yeah, over the past few episodes, actually, we've reached out to women like Emily Bellet, for example, and like Leila, who are very well-versed when it comes to the world of finance. Because we've noticed, and we've discussed this with them, that girls, in contrast to guys, maybe don't talk about this topic as regularly. Mm-hmm. And it's something that we've noticed that we've started to be increasingly interested in, because you know, when you're younger and when you're a student, you think about money more in the short term, and you know, you think, how much do I need to save up for this holiday at the end of the year, how much do I need to save up for Christmas, how much do I need to save up for whatever it is that you want to buy. But, you know, as we're approaching our late 20s, or me, I should speak for myself. You know, you kind of start to think about building a life. And, you know, I mean, I'm nowhere near being settled down. Nerea is closer to being settled than I am. But you start thinking about what you growing your money, I guess, not just in the short term but more in the long term.
And how do you even start? Because we're not really taught how to start. So
yeah, how to start building wealth and investing money to give you, you know, you start. I attended this was one of the workshops actually held by Emily Bellet, who, by the way, for anybody who hasn't listened to that episode, I highly recommend it. She's the founder of VestPod. Emily worked for Lehman Brothers, and she's now founded a company called VestPod. She's got another podcast called The Wallet, which is great. And she teaches women how to become, how to manage their finances and helps them gain that financial freedom that we all want. Because, you know, the point isn't not to work. I think I'll always work in some form, but you know, she wants to alleviate that pressure that a lot of us feel, where you feel that you have to work to sustain your lifestyle. And having more flexibility to dedicate your time to something that you're passionate about comes with financial freedom. So, you know, the better versed you become at managing your finances in the long run, the more freedom, the more options you're giving yourself ultimately. And so we're just trying to encourage girls, guys, everyone to just talk about finance and introduce certain concepts that are quite new to us. Leila talks about cryptocurrencies, for example. Yeah. She explains what blockchain is.
Which is something really difficult to like get your head around if you're not really kind of techie, in a sense. It's just quite a difficult concept, and I think because it's such a new thing, people don't really know where to even start, how to even find cryptos. If you don't have someone in your family or in your close group of friends, it's difficult to find out about this stuff. Like, obviously, you know, you can search online and things, but it is just quite a difficult concept to get your head around.
Yeah, and I mean, there is a lot of information online, mm-hmm. which is super helpful. Well, I mean, it's been around for years. I'm not going to say it's, like, brand new, but in terms of you know, relative to money as we have known it traditionally, it's quite a new concept. And so it's just hard to know which information to trust online, because there's it's something that's clustered with a lot of risk at the moment. And anyway, so yeah, we've invited women like Emily and like Layla, who just have so much experience in this field. Layla writes about women who have achieved that financial freedom and become financially independent, and they've built generational wealth for their families. And so that's what inspired me basically to reach out to Layla and invite her to join us, because I think it's so important that we hear more about these stories. And we actually spoke to Layla about the fact that a lot of women especially run into money issues if and when they get divorced from their husbands, because maybe they've built a family, the woman oftentimes takes time out of work, she doesn't have as much savings, she hasn't invested as much into her pension, and so that's one of the reasons why women tend to be financially less secure than men. And so I was curious, Naz, what do you think about prenups? And for anyone that's not familiar with prenups, it's essentially an agreement that you sign before you get married, which allocates your wealth, basically.
So your money's your money and your partner's is his or hers. And then it's basically when you get divorced that...
If you get divorced, obviously nobody enters a marriage planning to get divorced. No. But the whole point is, you know, you prepare for that eventuality should it happen.
Yeah.
And so it's basically, it can depend on what you agree upon, I guess, because it's essentially a contract. So it doesn't necessarily have to be your money is your money, my money is my money. That does tend to be the point, but you can agree different terms. And it's essentially just a way of...
dividing as well. I don't know.
Yeah, really. It's like a clean break. It's like planning for a clean break so that you don't have to have these discussions at the point of divorce. And so the reason why I'm asking you this is because I asked our dad.
Yeah, he has a strong opinion about this.
Yeah, he thought they were just so wrong.
Yeah.
And I was just really curious to know what you thought, because he thought, you know, if two people love each other, you can't go into a marriage signing a prenup because it implies that somebody doesn't trust the other, or that he thought it was insulting, like someone's marrying for money.
And he thinks it's like you're starting on a negative point rather than kind of starting all positively. And it is like a nice thing to not have a prenup. Like, you are generous with your money, you kind of give everything to each other. But I do understand that you might want the security to have your own finances. I mean, I'm not close to getting married, but I don't think I'll do a prenup. Oh, well, I might. I don't know. I haven't really thought about it too much. But I know, like, my partner's parents do have one. But, for example, in that case, what they did was put, for example, the house and kind of material things under the wife's name, who she hadn't worked for 7 years, and then he had his business. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So they did that so she was secure, and if anything did happen, but it's not only a divorce, like, would this help if, for example, one of them, unfortunately, something happens to them? Would that, like, would the prenup kind of...
Wait, are you asking me?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm not an expert, but from what I know, no.
No,
That's a will, Nez. When someone dies, are you implying someone dies?
Yeah.
That's just a will?
No, but I mean...
Oh, God.
If something... I don't know.
No, just no.
Well, anyway, I don't know. I mean, I understand why they're good and why they're not bad.
Have you spoken to your boyfriend's parents about prenups? That's what surprises me. You've spoken about prenups with your potential mother and father-in-law.
Well, because I asked him and he was like, yeah, my parents have one.
Oh, you asked him? You didn't ask about his parents?
No, because Dad was like, oh, you know, when you do get married and stuff, and, like, you share everything. And I was like, oh, well, you know, my boyfriend's parents don't. They have a prenup. And Dad was like, oh, no, that's so wrong. You need to share everything. And that's why I know that they have a prenup. My boyfriend explained that that's why. So because his mum stopped working, she had the house and stuff, so she was secure.
But it was your boyfriend who told you. You didn't speak to your
His mum and dad. I think they've mentioned it at some point. I mean, it's not really that confidential, is it?
I mean, it's a pretty personal thing to say, yeah.
Yeah, but if you're within a family, I don't know.
Yeah.
I just think that...
No, I guess.
Why not have an open conversation? I don't know what
No, no, no. I'm all up for open conversations, yeah. But I mean, I don't know. I just assume some people...
I mean, not the first month we were together, but I mean, I think it's come up.
Okay.
Or maybe it hasn't, I don't know. I mean,
and
maybe...
so what did Dad say?
That we should just share everything. That everything should be shared.
Yeah, but what was his logic?
To just start with a clean slate that we're building our life together, and together means sharing everything. Like, you'd share a house, you'd share children, you'd share money.
Yeah, but to me, a prenup isn't necessarily not a clean slate. It just means, in fact, it's more of a clean slate. Because it's like saying, the things we have, like, say one of the people in the couple is more wealthy than the other.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know, I feel like, firstly, it's not fair necessarily that they have to split it, but it by signing a prenup, it's almost like saying, the amounts that we have prior to this don't matter, like, what we're going to build from now, that can be split. I don't think necessarily that, say someone's married for 20 years,
mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily think a prenup should reflect what will happen with the money during the marriage, but whatever... those two people go into the marriage with, I think that should remain.
Yeah.
Like, in my opinion. I don't know. I just think it's logical. I think it's the most fair way to do it.
I mean, I don't really know. I kind of understand both perspectives. I don't know what I would do. But I think maybe prenups are more... They're kind of more important when people are very wealthy. As in, like,
yeah.
If one of them's a billionaire and the other one is not. But then it's like...
Oh my
if
God,
you are, okay, I mean, that's a bit much. But if you are, like, for example, a billionaire and you do get married, it's like, well, why not share it out? But then it's like, oh no, if you do, then they might marry you for the wrong reasons. I don't know, I'm not
arguably,
a billionaire.
Arguably, if you're a billionaire, quite frankly,
you don't really care.
You should give Leah, like, you probably would care. Well, I don't know, maybe you'd care more. Because, like, I mean, you are giving away more, way more. But at the same time, like, you still have so many billions, like, I don't know.
We're not
but yeah, like, I get, let's say one of the people has a million.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start with a more accessible or, like, a more realistic.
Yeah.
So, like, let's say one of them has a million.
Yeah.
And the other has saved 100,000.
Mm.
In that case, I still think the person with the million should keep their million. Like, I think it's unfair to then say, okay, here you go, have half a mil.
Yeah. I mean, it's different when, for example, you have children and traditionally, I mean, most of the time the woman does stop working, obviously, because breastfeeding, I mean, the children are more dependent at the start. So they do take time off. I think it's more important for that because imagine if, for example, you have four kids, right? One after the other. Like, for example, our... grandma did. So in 5 years she had four kids, which means that they are all incredibly dependent on her. So she physically cannot work because you've had four children in 5 years. And then,
oh my God,
for
by
example,
the time she was 25 she had had four kids.
No, I
how
know
scary.
I mean, imagine us with four kids. I couldn't. Or if she did have a prenup, it's like, wait, so I've raised our children for obviously more than 5 years because the little one's still dependent. I haven't even had the chance to work and build my own thing. So, like, it's not fair that your money isn't mine as well. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but that to me is separate because that's money that the man earns throughout the marriage. I do think that money should go towards her in part. But that's a different thing. What I'm saying is if he was a millionaire prior to getting married, why is that relevant to, but I don't know, maybe that comes, like, I remember Emily mentioning in the episode with her, like, or actually maybe it was in the pensions workshop that I attended, it was about men paying into the woman's pension.
Mm-hmm.
And that I do think is, like, a way to mitigate the effects of a woman getting pregnant and having loads of children, because a pension is essentially like a saving account, but you're investing, so it's a fund, and mm-hmm. you know, that money is invested, so it grows in theory throughout time, and so obviously if the man contributes towards his pension and the woman doesn't for, let's say, 10 years, then obviously the woman isn't going to have anywhere near as much money by the time she retires, which isn't fair because she's taken that time out to build something that was mutual between the both of them. But then that can be mitigated with, you know, say they sign a prenup or not, whatever. The man could then pay some money into the woman's pension.
Mm-hmm.
That to me is fair.
Yeah. I mean, well, yeah, because you need that stability. Like, if you have children, it is a mutual thing. So you have to take responsibility. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
I think the paying into the pension is definitely fair.
Anyways, we digress. We just wanted to cover some of the, express some of our thoughts when it comes to money and finance and financial freedom and stability. And
yeah.
Because obviously money isn't everything and money can't buy you happiness. No. And I say that in air quotes because it does give you...
It gives you freedom. It gives you stability.
To an extent.
Obviously to an extent.
It obviously depends what lifestyle you want to lead and stuff, but you know... You open your doors to more options and you give yourself, say you get pregnant and you want to take time off for 3 years. If you have that financial security built somehow,
then you can enjoy that time as well.
Yeah. Cause... Yeah. Without the stress and without reliance on a man or a partner or parents or inheritance or anything else. So anyway, that was just a discussion that we wanted to share with you all.
And if you have any other opinions, please let us know because we'd like to open up the conversation and know what you guys think as well. Like, what do you think about prenups and
pensions,
everything that we've discussed? Yeah.
Yeah. And if there's any questions that you have or anything that you want to hear about, let us know and we'll try and scout out some people that can come and clarify.
Exactly. Because we are definitely not experts. We're just having an open conversation.
Yeah. And we'd like to clarify that this episode, whether it's things that we discuss with Layla or between ourselves, is not financial advice. And on that note, we really hope you enjoy this episode.
Hi, Layla. How are you? Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
No, you're welcome. We're excited to have you. So for everyone listening, could you please tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and what it is that you do in your day-to-day?
Well, I'm a junior investing reporter for Insider, more widely known as Business Insider. I'm from the markets division, and I predominantly write about investing stories and anything that we think our readers would benefit from learning from exclusive interviews and people with extensive background, whether it's in crypto or in investing in stocks or ETFs.
Cool. And I read somewhere that you were in foreign policy international relations prior to this, right? How did you go from there into journalism? What motivated you?
Well, I started off, my bachelor's degree is a major in political science. And then I had a master's degree in international relations. And my most recent experience was actually at the United Nations. And my last experience was I was monitoring intergovernmental negotiations for nuclear weapons, chemical, biological weapons, but mostly nuclear weapons. And it happens once every year during the General Assembly. So I got to cover it. And I was basically in these meetings where I was seeing diplomats negotiating with each other for policy measures that would take place in the next year or so. And on the sideline of these meetings between government officials, the private sector would come in and introduce new technology and innovations and try to pitch how these technologies could help with things such as negotiating or trading and trade agreements. And one of the things that I started realizing was that there was a shift in the world from really centralized systems to decentralized systems. And that's how I was introduced to blockchain technology. I went to one of these sideline meetings and there was a technology firm that had built a sort of government system using blockchain. And that was the first time I had heard of it. I had no idea what it was. And they were explaining it as this decentralized system that was on this digital ledger that could be tracked and traced and transparent. And I got interested in it. And I started realizing that there's an economic shift happening too. That's this decentralization with the internet, with various sectors. And so I was learning all of these things, but I was covering it from a perspective of on behalf of sort of writing articles for the UN. And what I wanted to do was really be able to write for people, because I was like, this is amazing information that I wanted to be able to translate it in a way. Well, what does this mean to the everyday person? And so I started looking into blockchain technology and learning about crypto, realizing that cryptocurrencies were actually linked to blockchains. And that's kind of how it started. And so I became a journalist so that I could write for the everyday person. And I started covering investing because I felt that that was the new frontier of the way that our world was moving.
Wow, that's so interesting. I've always interpreted blockchain and cryptocurrencies as a way for people to take control without the interference of banks or governments and stuff.
Well, the beauty of the blockchain technology is that it has such a wide use case. So it can be used in so many ways, because it's a way that you can build smart contracts on it. And so anyone can use it, from an individual to an institution. You can build all sorts of programs on it. And that's, you know, sort of where the value of this technology comes from.
Wow. Okay. So what exactly is blockchain, just for anybody listening?
Well, it's kind of like when the internet came to town, it was such a new concept that it was difficult to use language to sort of explain it, because you really didn't have much previous things to link it to. You can look at it as a decentralized system. Yes, it's connected to the internet in a way, although you can build a private sort of ledger off of it. But for the most part, it's connected to the internet. And it's just a variation of nodes, or you can call them different computers, if you want to use that term, that work together to verify transactions on the blockchain. So everything is sort of on chain, and you can see things happening. And I'm trying to find maybe the best term or layman's term to use, but you can think of it as kind of like the internet, except it's using many systems to verify the movement of transactions, if you want to use the word transactions.
Okay.
And a lot of people say it's not safe to use, or people, I think, are very reluctant to use it. But do you see any advantages of using crypto?
In terms of the security element of it, some of the reporting that I've done and some of the people that I've talked to that have had cryptocurrency since 2017, some of them even before that. One popular sort of saying that I've heard from these sources is, not your keys, not your crypto. And so they talk about having this hardware called a cold wallet or a cold storage, where it kind of looks like a USB, but you can store your crypto on there, and it kind of takes it offline. And they say that, you know, that's the safest way to hold your crypto. And that is assuming that you're holding a large amount of crypto. And so what we call whales, which are those that own, I believe, more than 1,000 Bitcoin in their wallet, they're referred to as crypto whales. Usually they keep that in what is called a cold storage or a cold wallet, and that secures them. Except the downside of that is that you have to remember the password, which is an elaborate list of words in an order. And so if you forget that password, then that might be difficult. But most of the sources that I've spoken to have brought this up and how they store their crypto.
Wow, that's terrifying. Just out of curiosity, do you have to interview a lot of investors?
I tend to like to interview a lot of individuals, because I find that their stories are easily relatable to anyone that wants to learn how to invest or how to change their thoughts about money. And so I found through my reporting that when I interview a real person, especially someone who has had to figure it out on their own and was able to change the trajectory of their life, I find that readers resonate with that a lot. And so I try to make it a point to always look for interesting stories of people that have done great things. You can say ordinary people that have done extraordinary things and report on how they did it and their process. And everybody's journey is different, but there's a lot of things that you can learn from people's journeys and you can take and integrate into your own. And so I love these kinds of stories myself, and it is my passion.
That's actually how we came to know you. We read an article that we loved, which you wrote in May this year. We'll provide a link for anybody listening in the description. And it was a story about a woman called Kayana Danielle, who's a 37-year-old self-made millionaire who went from basically struggling to pay her own rent to then, I think it was like $2 million in generational wealth for her and her family. And it was in under 10 years. It was such a interesting story because we recently interviewed Emily Bellet, who's the founder of Vestpod, and she used to be an investment banker. She now dedicates her time to educating women and empowering women through education about how to manage their personal finances. And we were just talking to her about the fact that there's a still quite a big discrepancy between women and men when it comes to investing, when it comes to savings, when it comes to pensions. Like, men just generally tend to have more money than women, basically, and they tend to talk about money more and things. And so the fact that, you know, your story really resonated with us, because it was also timing, it was, you know, a prime example of a woman who had made it and had gone from, I don't want to say nothing, but had gone from being a normal woman, in air quotes, to, you know, like you said, doing something extraordinary. And it was just such a good message.
Yeah, thank you for that. Danielle was one of the stories that I did, but there was also another story, Lakeisha Simmons. She was a single mother, also learning to manage her finance. Another story I did was Sharon Sung. She's a 30-year-old that managed to build a real estate portfolio with upwards of 13 units that are rentable. Josephine Lee was another story that I did. Also, she went through a divorce and came out of it in debt, and she had to move back in with her parents. And she also built her finances in a way where she was able to reach a level of financial freedom as well. So there's a lot of wonderful women that I've covered their stories. And I think it's really important that when we do talk about money, that we talk to people that have been through it, because they show that it's possible that with the right understanding and the right education, you can make small decisions that can bit by bit change the trajectory of your financial situation over, you know, a matter of years. It doesn't happen overnight, but there, what I've noticed from my sources and the people that I've interviewed is that it happens gradually with small decisions. And that's one of the messages that I try to share as I share these stories with readers, because the idea is really overwhelming, especially when you're coming from a place where you don't know where to start or you feel like you're out of sorts or out of luck. And these stories, they start from that place, because a lot of us, I think, have been there, and a lot of us can relate to that. And that first step is the hardest step, but then it's just little baby steps that really make a difference.
Yeah. Have you spotted any trends in the women that you've interviewed?
Well, I can say with Lakeisha Simmons and Josephine Lee, these were two women that had gone through a divorce, and from my reporting, I knew that they, I guess when they were married, they depended a lot on their partner to make financial decisions on their behalf and on behalf of the family. And so if Josephine, for example, had a paycheck and she would bring it home, but she was very dependent on having her husband sort of figure out how that was going to be spent. And she said that she didn't trust herself as much. And when she went through the divorce, it sort of pushed her to face things on her own. And she had to change her perception about needing to make financial decisions for herself. And that's when she moved back home with her parents, and she has a son, and they lived with her parents, and she worked with a financial advisor as well. And she, you know, from her perspective, it was learning to trust herself and to trust that she's capable of making financial decisions for herself and her future. And with Lakeisha Simmons, it was the same thing. It was her perception about money in her marriage was that, you know, they spent a lot of money on big ticket items, cars, a big home. And when she went through her divorce, she felt less financially secure as she did in her marriage, because there was two breadwinners and then now it was just her. So the fear of, what if I lose my job? If I lose my job, I won't be able to pay my bills. And that prompted her to find a way to get to a place where she had enough financial cushioning that she was doing the job because she loved the job and not because she needed the paycheck.
That's so interesting, actually, because I attended a workshop about pensions, which I know sounds really distant because I'm 28 years old right now. But that's actually one of the things they mentioned. This is one of Emily's workshops, and she had four different women in the world of finance come to talk to us. And, you know, often we start to invest in our pensions later than we probably should, just because you don't relate to who you're going to be in 40 years time. You know, you don't see 70-year-old you and think, oh, I need to start preparing for that person's future. And so that's why a lot of people put off the pensions decision. Also, a lot of the time it's something that gets taken care of by your employer. So a lot of people don't even have a personal pension. But anyway, at the end of the workshop, Emily said, what piece of advice would you give to women? And one of them said, if you get a divorce, make sure you think of your pension, because a lot of women apparently don't think about the pension. And what happens is, say a couple gets married at 30 years old, the man might contribute to his pension between, say, the ages of 30 and 40. Let's say the woman stops working, has three kids in that time, stays at home to look after the children, and she is contributing zero into her pension. Some couples do arrange for the man to pay into the woman's pension in the meantime, but oftentimes that's not a thing. And so she was saying, if you get a divorce, because something, I don't know, it's like over 50% of couples, I think, get divorced. She was saying, make sure you think about the pension, because if you haven't been contributing for 10 years, you're going to be at a huge deficit. And that's another reason why women are often so financially insecure.
Yes, absolutely. It's a different, it could be a different mindset from what I've seen. It's almost a different mindset that you have in a marriage as opposed to outside of a marriage. And from what I've heard from my sources, and so it's important to learn from other people, and so that you're preparing yourself financially for whatever you think you may need down the line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%. A lot of women don't actually talk about finance, cryptocurrencies, about investing in general. Why do you think that is? Why do you think women talk about it less than men do?
Well, it's very hard to speculate, because it could be so many different reasons. But what I am noticing is that more and more women are starting to talk about it. And the ones that have ventured into investing and finance have started to go online and share it. And so there's a lot of great influencers now, female influencers, that are talking about it more and more. And I think that pattern, we're starting to see that change.
I do think it is risky business, though. Not just things like influencers, because you never, you know, an influencer isn't, they could be potentially a financial advisor, and they could be in the world of finance, but they're often not.
Yeah.
That's another reason why I really loved your article that I read about Danielle, because you mentioned her level of risk tolerance. I think you called it, like, people have to begin to gauge how willing you are to take a risk, because there are lots of different types of investment, different types of platforms that carry a different level of risk. Could you talk to us a little bit about that, about managing risk in investments, I guess?
Well, I am not a financial advisor, but I can tell you from people that I've spoken to and financial certified financial planners that I've spoken to that say understanding your risk tolerance is important, because with anything, when you invest, there are layers and levels of risk, but there's always risk involved. And so understanding your ability to tolerate risk is important because it helps you make informed decisions. And so if you're investing, let's say, and this is an example, a certain amount of money that you can't afford to lose, and the market is volatile, and so investing that money is probably not a good idea, because the market is going to go up and down and nobody really can time the market or understand the market. But long-term investing and, you know, educating yourself about what are stable opportunities or options, as opposed to maybe investing in single stocks, you can look at ETFs or mutual funds. You'll understand that over a longer period of time, that's their growth potential, you know, over a span of 10 years, 20 years. But day to day, they are volatile. And so if you're investing money that you can't afford or you need, you know, that's not a good sign. And so risk tolerance is your capacity emotionally to handle the volatility. Don't put in more money than you can emotionally handle to see go down, because it will happen. Risk capacity is like your ability, your actual ability to invest and risk this particular amount of money. So you have to take into consideration two different things: your tolerance, which is your mental, emotional, and your capacity, which is how much can you afford to invest. And all of those two things are very important. And from experts that I've spoken to, there are a variety of things that also need to be in place before you consider investing and before you consider risk tolerance and whatnot. And that's that you have a cushion, a good amount of savings that can cushion you. I've heard 3 to 6 months, and more recently from financial advisors, I've heard, hey, if you can get 12 months, that's great, especially with COVID recently. And we've seen a lot of people lose their jobs. And also a retirement account. If you have a tax advantage retirement account that you can contribute to, you should consider these two things first. And if you've checked the boxes there, then you can start to consider investing. And that's when you ask yourself, okay, what is my risk tolerance and what is my risk capacity?
Yeah, that's such a good point. And this is potentially a little bit far-fetched, but because everything is going more decentralized, do you see crypto becoming more popular than the funds we're used to seeing? Or do you still think it's going to be a while to see that become the norm, if it ever does?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer because there's a lot of moving targets in that. I can say that I recently spoke to and did an interview with Matthew Lemaire. He's the founder of Fifth Era, which is a blockchain venture capital firm that is invested in over 300 projects. I believe it's about $30 billion worth of investments. So there are people that really understand this technology very well, that they feel that right now is equivalent to the dot-com boom. And we're about 1997, 1998 of the internet boom. And so this technology is, you know, in the early stages of that. And there are other people like financial advisors that don't see it that way and see it as risky and don't advise their clients. And so from my reporting, I've seen a wide range of perspective on it.
I'd be interested to know if, I mean, again, speculative, but do you think as financial advisors, they would understand less about the technological aspect of it? And so they'd be more reluctant to want to advise on something they can't, you know, physically understand in terms of the technology. Whereas, you know, people who understand the technology would be more pro it.
Well, there's also the idea that cryptocurrency is extremely volatile. Unlike, you know, traditional equities, they are volatile. But when you look at cryptocurrency, we saw Bitcoin in May drop by 50% in a very short period of time. And so that level of volatility isn't good for someone who's trying to build long-term wealth and retirement money. And, you know, certified financial planners are focused, from what I know, they're focused on getting their clients to retirement and to a comfortable retirement. And cryptocurrency is something of a still speculative, and you're investing in a type of technology that you either believe in or you don't. And so they're two different things. And depending on who you ask and where they stand, that perspective will vary.
Oh, now that I remember, El Salvador has actually introduced Bitcoin as an official currency in their country. Do you think that other countries will follow suit, or do you think they will be a little bit reluctant?
Well, that's an interesting question. And I think it has to do with how El Salvador does in this process. And the reason I say that was because in a recent interview with the executive president of the Central American Bank for Economic Integration, Dante Masse, he had said that he did have other Central American countries contact him to ask him about the El Salvador process. This particular bank is assisting El Salvador in the transition. They're providing technical assistance. And so I had the opportunity to interview him to ask, you know, how is this going to work? Because it's very volatile, and how do you use it to transact? And so during that conversation, that comment did come up that indeed there were other countries that had contacted him, showing a level of interest in how it goes. And he assumed that it was because there was interest.
Wow. A little guinea pig.
Yes. I think what's interesting about El Salvador's situation in particular was that Bitcoin was used in small towns along the coast, as what I know from Mr. Masse, and that it had sort of evolved from there. And he suspects that it was actually surfers from the U.S. that would go down to surf in El Salvador in these coastal towns and basically use Bitcoin to get around the high transfer fees. And so he had mentioned that there were Bitcoin machines or Bitcoin ATMs in these little towns, all over these little towns, and that was sort of a surprise to him because they were kind of secluded towns. And so that was what they had thought had happened, and they want to investigate that further. And so they saw an opportunity to take something that was already happening and expand on it in a way that it could be nationwide.
Wow, that's super interesting.
Well, from what I've observed and from what I've seen, it seems that countries that rely on remittances are more likely to lean towards Bitcoin because it's its ability to transfer cross-border that gives it a sort of value point. And with El Salvador, one of the things that had come up during my interview with Mr. Masse was that the expats, the El Salvadorian expats that lived in the U.S. wanted to be able to transfer money to their relatives without incurring the high transfer fees that come from something like a centralized money transfer. And he had told me that some of the reports that he had seen was as much as you can incur as much as a $30 to $40 fee by even if you want to transfer an amount of $100 or $200. So that's a substantial amount. And so people started using Bitcoin to transfer remittances into the country. And that's sort of how it started there.
Wow. So cool.
Yeah, very cool.
Well, Layla, thank you so much for coming onto our podcast and having this conversation with us. Both me and Lara are going to go and do more research into investing into cryptocurrencies.
I've bookmarked your page already. I want to hear from all those female investors.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me as a guest. And I'm glad that I could bring an interesting perspective.
Definitely. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thanks so much for listening, guys. We really hope you enjoyed the episode. As always, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe. We love hearing from you. Bye.